Welcome to the podcast ministry of Grace Anglican Church in Grove City, Pennsylvania. It is our hope to proclaim the historic faith and the dazzling grace of Jesus Christ. For more information about our church, please check out our website at graceanglicanonline.com.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. The Marquis de Lafayette was a French officer who assisted George Washington during the Revolutionary War. After the war was over, Lafayette returned to his homeland, returned to France, and resumed his life as an aristocrat and a farmer. In 1783, the harvests were terrible, and many suffered as a result. Some were even starving. But because of his own careful planning and especially skilled farming, or those whom he had hired, Lafayette's farms were unaffected by the crop's failure. One of his workers offered what seemed to be sound and wise advice. He said to Lafayette, "The bad harvest has raised the price of wheat. Can you imagine the profit from this year? Now is the time to sell." After thinking about the starving peasants, Lafayette said, "No, now is the time to give. Now is the time to give." That is the generous undercurrent of the opening address of the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, a word that means supreme blessedness. Jesus gave us eight of them, and each of those eight have three parts. Each beatitude begins with a blessing. That blessing is attached to an audience, and that audience is given a new destiny. So I'd like to speak about each part of the Beatitudes this evening. They begin with a blessing. The Greek is makarios. It is translated variously in the New Testament. The word is used 50 times. 44 of those times it is translated blessed. 6 of those times it is translated happy. Various translations prefer one over the other. Most side with blessed, though some try the happiness route. The happiness idea as it relates to the Beatitudes was picked up by Robert Schuller, that prince of the pulpit from the Crystal Cathedral, who after reading the Beatitudes was inspired to write a book entitled The Be Happy Attitudes, believing that Jesus' words at the Sermon on the Mount were a pathway to psychological happiness. So which is it, blessed or happy? It's an important question because they do differ. The one comes from the outside, and the other is produced from the inside. Blessing is declared upon someone from without. Happiness is felt from within. So which is it? Well, the Beatitudes themselves, I argue, do not favor the happy translation because they address experiences that are distinctly unhappy. For example, mourning. It would be very strange indeed if the Beatitudes said, "Happy are they who mourn." They're not happy because they're mourning. Additionally, the blessing translation fits much better within the well-established biblical pattern. This is the tradition that shaped the intelligence and wisdom of Jesus Christ. This practice goes back to the earliest days of creation, but here's what blessing is within Scripture. At least most of the time, blessing involves a party with greater legitimacy bestowing favor or a special regard on someone of lowly estate, and by that dignification, raises them to a new status. Blessing is easily likened to the practice of knighting someone. You know that when Queen Elizabeth II, in her aged frame, picks up the sword and hopes not to graze the ears of those she is knighting, has changed nothing about the ontology of the person she is knighting. Anthony Hopkins is still Anthony Hopkins, but now He is a knight of the realm, Sir Anthony Hopkins. He is given a dignity that was external to him, that came upon him because of the gift of the queen. Similar thing happens in Blessing, where the more legitimate party grants favor to those of lowly estate, and by that favor raises them up. We see this in the earliest moments of creation. What does God do with the Sabbath day? It's just day seven, friends, until God blessed it and made it holy. Whenever God creates human beings in his own image and likeness, he then blesses them. And in that blessing, he tells them, go be fruitful and multiply. So that's fun. And also, thank you for laughing. The first crowd was dead as a doornail. They didn't respond at all. So shy. And the other was to go and subdue creation, exercise dominion over the world. Those two things occurred because of the blessing of God. Abraham experiences the blessing of God. He was a moon-worshipping pagan whom God visited, and God blessed Abraham and said, in light of this new blessing, that Abraham would be the father of nations. You may remember the episode where Jacob was wrestling the angel or some sort of theophany, and at one point Jacob was prevailing and said to his competitor, I won't let you go until you bless me. And the angel or God does bless Jacob, and then Jacob becomes Israel and gets a whole new start at life. This is what blessing does. It exalts the one who is blessed. And this is exactly what Jesus is doing in the Beatitudes. He looks at his audience, principally disciples, some in the crowd who have gathered, and he says, blessed are you. And when Jesus says blessed, he is not addressing a pleasant psychological feeling that his listeners are experiencing. Instead, he is doing something far grander and far stabler. He is declaring the disposition of heaven, that heaven looks upon you in your state right now favorably. Heaven gives you new dignity. In this moment, you are no longer the person that you were 5 minutes ago. You are now given a new status. You are blessed by heaven. More than that, it's unconditional blessing. Notice the Beatitudes do not say you are blessed if you do thus and such, if you become poorer in spirit, if those who mourn become mournier. Instead, you are blessed in your state of poverty, in your state of mourning. The blessing arrives in your present circumstances. That's the blessing that elevates the status of Jesus' listeners. But also, we have an audience, in fact, various audiences, or various aspects of the same audience. But the audience is strange and unexpected. The ancients described various groups as blessed. The gods were often considered blessed. Why? Because they were removed from the difficulty of human experience. The dead were considered blessed, because they were unburdened from those same painful realities. The rich were considered blessed because they could afford comforts that would prevent them from hurting too much. But blessing seemed to mean unafflicted, untarnished, undiminished, above the fray. Blessed, in some ways, was a shorthand also for success. And we use the word like this to some extent. I was reading on Facebook the other day, which I am prone to do from time to time, just to see the ways of wisdom. And somebody had written something about how blessed we are to be Americans. Now, what do they mean by that? That we had certain advantages from being citizens of Western democracy. Some people describe wealth as a blessing. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could retire in our mid-50s? That's my current trajectory. But blessed are the well-educated. We could say that. Blessed are the well-traveled. Blessed are the well-healed. Blessed are the multilingual. Blessed are those in their physical prime. Blessed are those who have climbed the Everest of personal achievement. And maybe have written a book about it. They evidence the favor of heaven. By contrast, at least within an ancient perspective, sufferers were often seen as lacking heaven's blessing. So if someone were mourning, per se, or had a poor spirit, or were persecuted, perhaps some karmic retribution was at play. maybe the reason that they're suffering is because they've done something wrong and they, in essence, deserve it, thus demonstrating heaven's displeasure. The disciples believe this. John chapter 9. Jesus sees a blind man. The disciples are standing near the blind man, talking about the blind man, rather rudely. And they want to know whose fault it is that he's blind. Did he do something in utero, or was it one of his relatives? Is that why he's blind? I often joked that the reason that I'm bald is because I mocked the son of my minister, who when he was 17 started to lose his hair. It only took a year, friends. I was 18 when I noticed something was changing. It was divine punishment. But Jesus blesses a surprising audience. An old rabbi once said to his disciples, "In olden days there were men who saw the face of God." The youngest disciple asked, "Why don't we see God anymore?" The old rabbi replied, "Because nowadays no one stoops low enough." The blessing of Jesus hovers low. And who does it target? It targets those who are afflicted by the fall, as well as those who are most vulnerable within a fallen world. That's what we have in the Beatitudes, two groups: those afflicted, the poor in spirit, the mournful, and the persecuted. That is, victims of a malignant and malicious world, a rebel-filled world. Also, the vulnerable, the meek, who are always vulnerable to the powerful, those who hunger for righteousness, who are vulnerable to those who compromise, the merciful, who are vulnerable to the malignant, the pure in heart, who are vulnerable to those who have soiled souls, and peacemakers, who are vulnerable to pretty much everybody. The blessing of Jesus hovers in a unique valley. It doesn't scale the mountaintops. It's not hanging out with the trophy winners or those who have succeeded. It's not with the people who have been noticed. It's with those whom the world would designate as losers. It's with people who aren't going to have Wikipedia articles written about them because nobody cares enough to write the article. It's with those who have written books that nobody has read. It's with those who have grand ideas that nobody will listen to. With those who can barely get out of bed in the morning. If you want to know where the blessing of Jesus is, it's in those places in which we see the whole company of saints all fractured by the fall. And therein lies the scandal of Jesus. Therein lies the scandal of who he blesses. Now, earlier in the sermon, I made mention of the perspective that suffering was the evidence of non-blessedness. Now, I have to be careful, and this is a very difficult needle to thread, but let me say this. There are some biblical roots to that perspective. Now, here's what I mean. In the opening chapters of Genesis, you have God blessing his creation, blessing the man and the woman, blessing the Sabbath day, making it all holy, and elevating the dignity of all of those created things. However, in Genesis 3, after we imbibed the lie of the devil, all of a sudden, God changes his language and changes his relationship to us. He doesn't bless us anymore. Instead, he uses the word, and you know it, curse. Cursed are you. He curses the serpent, then the woman, then the man, then all of creation. Everything is cursed, meaning that there is now enmity, antipathy between heaven and earth, between God and human beings, and between human beings and human beings, and between human beings and the planet. We're all out of sorts, and curse means suffering. Things have fallen apart. The center didn't hold. And so now we're at each other's throats, and it's only a generation later that they still start killing each other. And so curse now defines, in many ways, broadly speaking, the experience of suffering and the fall. That we suffer because we are still under the penalty of the curse. But here's what's remarkable about the Sermon on the Mount. When God incarnate deigns to speak to his fallen audience, all of them fractured and crippled, I suppose he could have said something like this. "You know, I cursed you once. I banished all of you. And you deserved it. And you still bear all the marks of the curse. And truth be told, you deserve it more today than you did then. You're more damnable now than ever." But instead, when the infleshed God opens his 30-year-old mouth, he says to the fallen, Blessed are you. Blessed are you. This is a redefining moment. Something is happening in the heavens in which the old paradigm of a world dominated by an ancient curse is being lifted. Now it will be all the more lifted as Jesus, the blessed of God, becomes for us the cursed of God on the cross, so that the cursed of God might for all time be the blessed of God. That's skipping ahead a few chapters in Matthew. But notice how Jesus kicks off the Sermon on the Mount by opening heaven's vault, the treasury, and then handing out all the cash to the destitute. The Beatitudes are Jesus' way of saying, now is the time to give. Now is the time to give. This is the disposition of paradise. It's to give you the world. It's something about the blessing, something about the fallen, unexpected audience, and something now about destiny. Because each blessing has an audience, and each audience has a destiny. And Jesus, friends, doesn't speak empty words. He's not like us. He doesn't use filler. Jesus doesn't chatter. What he says, he means. That Jesus doesn't bless you as some liturgical phenomenon. It isn't just an empty sentiment. Notice that his blessing is attached to real consequences and real recovery. Now, the pledges in the Beatitudes are not principally, at least in our current circumstance, not principally about experience. They're about expectation. This is a recovery that is not yet fully grasped. 6 out of the 8 Beatitudes have a future tense. This is evidenced by the English word shall. Right? They shall be comforted. They shall inherit the earth. They shall receive mercy. They shall see God. They shall be called sons of God. This is eschatological language. This is heaven marrying earth language. This is the coming together of strands language. This is everything being solved language. These are words of future destiny. In other words, the Beatitudes are going to be said and said and preached about and preached about until a time that they all become true, until the destiny is fulfilled. Some of you have read The Lord of the Rings, or at least seen the films. In the conclusion of the books and the movies, after the Ring of Power is destroyed in Mount Doom and Frodo, who was terribly wounded earlier in the story, is about to leave his best friend Sam and enter the Grey Havens, which is a picture of heaven, he speaks to Sam very tenderly and speaks of his own need for a further cure, as well as Sam's need for a fuller cure and fuller life. And he says this to Sam, "I have been too deeply hurt, Sam. I tried to save the Shire, and it has been saved, but not for me. Do not be too sad, Sam. You shall not always be torn in two. You will be one and whole for many years. You have so much to enjoy and to be and to do." This is the meaning of the pledges within the Beatitudes. You shall not always be torn in two. Your circumstances as they are will not always be. You will outlast them all. Put another way, the blessed shall eventually, in fact, be happy. Your destiny is brighter than your journey. So in conclusion, friends, look for blessing where God has pronounced it. Look for blessing where God has pronounced it. We can easily make 2 errors as we think about blessing. First, we can automatically equate success with blessing. Look how well they're doing. Look how much money she's making. Look at his career. Look at his car. The thing is, worldly success, when it is divorced from a heaven-made, heaven-fashioned character, will lead to downfall. Success, when it is pried out of the fingers of Christ, can actually become curse, can bring you down, can devastate countless lives. But let us not automatically equate success with blessing. Two, we can make this mistake. We perceive suffering as the absence of blessing, adopt a karmic retribution theology, where we ask ourselves, or worse, ask others, when we notice the difficulty somebody is having, you know, I wonder what they did to deserve it. I wonder how they got in this situation. Maybe if they had ordered their steps differently, they wouldn't have ended up here. Maybe if I would have planned their lives, they wouldn't have ended up here. Those are the errors we need to avoid. The Beatitudes, friends, invite us to adopt heaven's perception of blessing. That is, having eyes which see a sufferer and then says about that sufferer, whether we like them or not, says there, them, right there, hovering over that head, the blessing of God. The blessing of God is hovering right over them. What a destiny God must have in store for them. What recovery. What recovery must heaven have in store for them? And it's not just about them in abstraction. It's about you. The same thing goes for you and for me tonight, my afflicted and vulnerable brothers and sisters. The blessing hovers here, over you, right now, in this moment. So, when you're poor in spirit, that you're so sad you can't eat, with suicidal thoughts, maybe even a few attempts, or you're aching over some romantic loss, or when you mourn, when you get predictably choked up every time you think about a face that has now vanished, or every road that you've taken has led to your regret, or when you're merciful and somebody takes advantage of you knowing that you're irenic and kind. Or when you're meek and you're therefore trampled upon, skipped over, or rejected as naive and simple. Or when all your levees have broken, your walls have tumbled, your friends have scattered, your world has burned to ash. Remember the Christ who calls you blessed. That same Christ looks into our bloodshot eyes this evening and says to us, I promise you the world. I promise you the world. And I will turn your ashen heaps into the orchards of Eden. Hear the generous words of heaven, loud and clear for all the world to hear. Blessed are you. Now is the time to give. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Coming your way. Oh, I once was loved.